طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. And that is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. During the corona crisis, one thing that has not been on lockdown is Israel's system of occupation and apartheid. On the contrary, the threat of annexation of part of the West Bank, arbitrary arrests of students and human rights activists, destruction of homes, fields, and health centers, murder of young Palestinians in the streets, have all continued apace. In this episode of This Week in Palestine, Firuz Sherkawi and Alice Sampson Estepe discuss the impact of the coronavirus in Palestine, how the Palestinians are organizing themselves to continue resisting the occupation, and how we can help to put an end to international complicity with the Israeli apartheid regime. About the speakers, Firuz Sherkawi is the advocacy coordinator of Grassroots Jerusalem, a platform for Palestinian and international activists and organizations in occupied Palestine. Alice Sampson Estepe is the European campaigns coordinator of the Palestinian BDS National Committee, the leadership of the BDS movement. This recording is from a recent webinar hosted by Palestine Podcast.
My name is Jasper. I am a member of Intel Antwerp. I will be moderating the discussion tonight. We have invited two very interesting speakers to our webinar tonight. First of all, Firuz Sherkawi. She will talk about Palestine in times of the pandemic. She'll be able to tell us more about developments on the ground, about the impact of the corona pandemic and the occupation on the daily life of Palestinians. So Firuz is the coordinator of Grassroots Al-Quds, which is a platform for Palestinian community-based mobilization, leadership and advocacy in occupied Jerusalem. The organization maps and networks in order for Palestinian communities in Jerusalem to resist the Israeli policies of displacement. And then secondly, I would like to present Alice Sampson Estepe. Alice is the coordinator of the BDS movement in Europe, and she has been organizing and coordinating campaigns against the international complicity with the Israeli occupation for a couple of years. She will tell us more about this complicity by focusing on the investments of AXA and about the campaign that has been launched to make the company divest. Firuz, let me just move to you straight away. So first of all, can you explain to us how the COVID-19 situation in Palestine has evolved since the first infections were detected? So how hard has the virus hit Palestine? What kind of measures were taken to curb a big outbreak, and were they effective? What is the situation like today?
Good evening. Thank you for hosting us tonight, and thank you for the introduction, Jasper. I think that to answer your question, we need to first of all realize that there are different parts of Palestine that have different realities. People living in the different occupied parts of Palestine have different direct realities, political, economic, socioeconomic. And so the COVID-19 pandemic also took different shapes in Palestine. So, for example, the Gaza Strip has been under siege for over 13 years now. And, of course, the daily reality in Gaza is a very harsh one. It's almost an inhumane place to live, and people face a lot of challenges, including of course the closure and the restriction on movement and development, but also the lack of medicine and medical centers and devices, and that is the usual reality in Gaza. So the COVID-19 brought a lot of fear towards what's going to happen in Gaza, for example. And luckily there wasn't a huge outbreak of COVID-19 cases in the Gaza Strip. Looking at the areas under direct Israeli, not only occupation, but also control bureaucratically and legally, in the 48 occupied territories, in the 48 occupied land, Palestinians faced neglect. And there was a lot of Palestinian criticism over the Israeli authorities that did not offer and provide enough testing kits and enough remedy to the situation, including also economically. But then looking at Jerusalem, for example, where I live and I am currently speaking from, there was both the occupation, the military occupation, business continuing as usual, and I will elaborate on this in a bit. So the things you mentioned, home demolitions, arrests and prosecution of Palestinians, the continuous and even speeded up annexation plan and implementation of the annexation, this is the reality that we lived in Jerusalem. And then there is the West Bank, where in the West Bank, supposedly at the face of it, the Palestinian Authority was in control. But of course, the Palestinian Authority was following orders, as usual, from the Israeli authorities. And that is why what we witnessed happening in the West Bank was the Palestinian Authority policing the Palestinian people, imposing restrictions on movement, preventing people from opening their businesses or going out in the street. And this is not to say that was not a good measure, but the Palestinian Authority's role stopped there. It stopped at policing the people without providing any remedy to the people, without providing the means to help the people survive. So, for example, when it comes to the West Bank, the statistics already show that there are 100,000 new poor families in the West Bank. This is a huge number, and poverty is rampant in the West Bank. It's not a new development, but the huge jump in the number of poor families reflects and indicates how poorly the Palestinian Authority reacted to the pandemic in terms of supporting the people economically and making sure that people are not paying the price during this very harsh time, and this is what that's exactly the result. This huge number of new poor, officially poor families, was a result of that. So, to summarize this divided answer, it really depends on what part of Palestine we are talking about and what is the political situation there, the legal situation there. What's common between all of these different parts is that the Palestinians, the Palestinians live a long-term pandemic. That is the Israeli occupation. And any new challenge, whether it is the COVID-19 or any other global or regional development, will add trouble to the Palestinians' challenges. And so it is double trouble for the Palestinians. How it reflected itself in the specific realities, I tried to explain shortly, but in general, what's common is being occupied and then hit with a pandemic means that challenges were just doubled and harshened, and it is very challenging for the Palestinian people these days.
Mm-hmm. So you talked about a couple of disturbing stories already. You mentioned some examples of what it means to be occupied in times of a pandemic. But is it possible to be a little bit more specific in terms of healthcare? So how does the occupation basically prevent an effective response to this pandemic?
Certainly. That the Israeli occupation authorities naturally don't put the Palestinians on top of their priority list. And when it comes to providing the needed test kits and health centers and any health-related measures within the context of a pandemic, very little was provided to the Palestinian communities. And for example, in Jerusalem, we witnessed a lot of cases of not only that the Israeli authorities did not provide that these measures and reactions in the Palestinian communities, but also harassed and prosecuted and prevented grassroots initiatives that grew within these communities and organized themselves in order to provide that remedy to the and assistance to the communities. So, for example, a clinic in Silwan, in the middle of Jerusalem, opened its doors to and provided testing kits for people. There were little to no testing kits in the Palestinian communities in the first few weeks of the pandemic and since the outbreak. And so it was a self effort. Indeed, in this case, the Palestinian Authority was involved. And that is why the Israeli occupation authorities shut down this clinic and prevented the testing from taking place as part of its usual reaction to any Palestinian organizing or Palestinians taking responsibility or a lead. The Israeli authorities, it's very important for them to prove that they are the bosses. They control Jerusalem, all of Jerusalem. And so we also saw how they raided Kfar Aqab. Kfar Aqab is a Palestinian neighborhood of Jerusalem. Even though it is within the municipal boundaries of Jerusalem, it is now located outside of the wall, behind the annexation and expansion wall. Israel wanted to cut off Kfar Aqab from Jerusalem because it is a place with 100,000 Palestinian residents, and that's a demographic threat in the Israeli terms. And so Kfar Aqab is neglected. It has been neglected by the Israeli authorities intentionally, systematically for many, many years, since the building and the construction of the wall took place in the year 2005 in that area. And Palestinians there do not receive the regular services that they are supposed to receive from the Israeli authorities, including building infrastructure, sufficient infrastructure, providing health services, and during the pandemic, there was again a need for organizing in order for this to happen, and the Palestinian Authority again hijacked the opportunity to do this show of sending its own police to Kfar Aqab in order to police the people and prevent the people from going out to the streets. And that is when Israel saw this as a challenge to its control over Jerusalem, its united, undivided, eternal capital, and they sent actual army forces into Kfar Aqab and again did the show of we are the bosses here, we control this area. And so we witnessed all of these incidents take place. There was a grassroots initiative that was distributing food parcels to families in need, because of course the poor, and that is true everywhere, the poor paid the highest price of this pandemic everywhere around the world. And so the poor families who did not have any economic security and who suddenly found themselves unemployed against their will were only growing poorer. And so there were many Palestinian initiatives organized all over Palestine, where community-based and grassroots groups started gathering donations and distributing food parcels to these families in need. And again, it happened in Sur Baher in March, when the Israeli police arrested some of the volunteers of one of these initiatives. They prevented them from distributing the food parcels. In the end, they did take it, take a step back and allow the food parcels to be distributed. But this doesn't mean that we can ignore again this show of power. So this is to say that when it comes to what it means to be a Palestinian under occupation and then under pandemic, it means that on the one hand, there is the pandemic with the challenges that it brings to the community, to the people. I mean, regardless of the occupation, Jerusalem is a touristic city, and 40% of the Palestinian economy in Jerusalem is dependent on tourism. And of course, with the pandemic and the halting of all movement of tourists and visitors into Jerusalem, the economy, the Palestinian economy in Jerusalem was hit hard, and shops had to close, and hotels had to send away fire employees because there is no business and they cannot keep them anymore. And so there is the there are the regular challenges that you face as a community hit with a pandemic. But then again, this challenge is troubled by an occupation that is relentless, that continues its business as usual even during the pandemic. And I the last point I want to make there is also to connect this to the larger context we're talking about today. During the pandemic closure, we witnessed also an accelerated action and activism when it comes to the annexation plans and the building of infrastructure that supports this annexation. So in Jerusalem, for example, the Israeli occupation authorities took advantage of the empty streets and started working day and night on the infrastructure for the new lines of the Jerusalem Light Rail. There are four new lines that are under construction right now, in addition to the existing so-called red line. And so and of course these lines all have one main purpose, which is to connect settlements around Jerusalem with the city center, making annexation happen de facto on the ground even before this suddenly important date of July 1st, 2020. It's important to realize that this annexation has been taking place for decades now, and I can again elaborate on this in a bit.
Thank you, Fairuz. So another point I wanted to make, or another question. So you say that the occupation, it basically touches upon every aspect of Palestinian lives. You talked about healthcare, but what about employment? So many Palestinians, they work in Israel. They work in illegal settlements to survive, basically. But in the context of the pandemic, well, many things happened as well. Would you be able to tell us something about Palestinian employment in Israel in the illegal settlements and how that has evolved the last couple of months? What this means for Palestinians?
Of course. Well, first of all, as ironic as it sounds, Palestinians have been building Israel since 1948, and that by itself is a huge thing, point to stop at and think about the fact that Palestinians find themselves forced to live, to work within the Israeli labor market, within the Israeli construction sector. Pandemic or not, it is an awful thing to have to do. And Palestinians, many of them, thousands of them, do not have the choice and end up working in the Israeli labor market. Of course, that a huge portion of these workers work in the construction sector. And when the pandemic started and the outbreak happened and measurements measures were taken and many sectors were shut down in the economy, in the Israeli economy. The Israeli authorities deemed the sector, the construction sector, an essential sector, just like the health services, just like the food shops. Construction was deemed essential, which was translated into thousands of Palestinian workers having to go to work during this pandemic to serve the Israeli colonial projects and colonial expansion and Israeli long-term plans. Now, these workers, again, even outside of the context of a pandemic, live very challenging conditions. They are the cheap labor. They don't get high salaries. They are easily replaced, getting rid of. They don't receive any benefits. They have no rights. It is very easy to find yourself just sent home from work. And so in the reality that preceded the pandemic, the conditions for these workers were harsh. And now with the pandemic, when the pandemic started and Israel deemed their work essential, they had to risk their health, their lives, their families' health in order to continue going to work. And again, many people wanted to continue to work also, but this again is that dilemma, it's that reality that we all need also to stop at and think about. Why do certain people in the world find themselves having to make that choice between surviving and risking their lives and their families' lives and health? And so these workers found themselves having to go to work, but then Israel conditioned that if they come from the West Bank to work in 48 occupied lands, they will need to commit to staying there for 60 days without going back. So they had to commit to staying there for 2 months without returning to see their families. But then again, if one of them caught the virus, they found themselves, you know, thrown at the checkpoint and just sent back to the West Bank without any care, without any even medical treatment or anything. They were just taken rid of and they were sent home. So it's an interesting thing to see that why? I mean, the question here to ask here is why is the construction sector more than others very important to Israel, and why it wasn't stopped during the pandemic? And again, this connects us to the question about annexation. And here, if you allow me, I would take a step back again and just clarify one point. As a Palestinian living here in Palestine, I can tell you that annexation has been happening on the ground since 1967. I mean, the fact that there is a big fuss about the annexation now should not make us forget that this annexation has been happening slowly, steadily, without any disturbance by Israel since the occupation of the West Bank, including Jerusalem, in 1967. And it is very easy to see in Jerusalem. Only now is Israel talking about annexing officially, legally, some parts of the West Bank, but this had already happened in Jerusalem in 1980, an expansion that started de facto in 1967 when Israel expanded the municipal boundaries of Jerusalem to include the newly occupied parts in the east. And so this is the context, okay? The annexation has been taking place for decades now, and this includes also what we know exists in the West Bank already, settlements, which can be residential or industrial zones. Israeli industrial zones are everywhere in the West Bank, sucking up our natural resources, preventing our own economy from being developed. So the roots, and not only roots, but a huge part of this tree has been growing for so long now. And again, during the pandemic, Israel found a very good opportunity to accelerate the annexation. And so we witnessed not only home demolitions, but also land confiscation, construction in the area called E1, which is part of the plan to create a so-called Greater Jerusalem Metropolis. And so it's in short, this annexation was accelerated. For the Palestinians, this annexation has been happening on the ground for so long. For us, it means that we simply cannot grow in our communities, simply cannot even live a normal relationship with our land, with our community, with our space. And the last point I would like to make here is that this enterprise, this big project that Israel has been implementing in the West Bank, cannot Israel alone cannot fund such a big project, and without international aid to Israel, Israel cannot realize these plans. And this aid is not only the $3.8 billion check that the United States of America sends to Israel every year, but rather also is funded by the business relations that Israel has been building and continues to build with international and multinational corporations that are involved in this enterprise. And here is where I will stop. I exceeded my time. I'm sorry. And we can listen to Alice talk exactly about that.
Yeah, thank you so much, Fairuz, for painting a very clear picture. And I think on your last point, I would like to move to Alice, because she will talk to us about the international complicity with Israeli apartheid and the Israeli occupation. So like Fairuz said, there are many structural issues that sustain the occupation, basically. And we won't go into all of these different obstacles, of course, but we would like to specifically focus on the complicity of businesses and of AXA Insurance in particular. So before we move on to AXA's complicity in the Israeli occupation, I would like to ask you if you could just shortly explain what the BDS movement is for those who don't know. How did it come to life? What are its strategies, its objectives? And maybe how you would judge its impact over the years. Let us start with that.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for having me here. It's an honor to be here and talking next to Fairuz. So thank you, Intel, for organizing this and inviting me. And I hope that everyone who's listening to us from wherever that you're all safe. Thank you so much, Fairuz, for giving such a good context and explaining so comprehensively what is happening on the ground. And just on the note you ended on, it's so important that people understand that Israel can only maintain its oppression on Palestinians thanks to international support. So Israel's continuous impunity of 70 years of ongoing Nakba, the regime of occupation, apartheid, and colonialism over the Palestinian people, is held because of the support from the international community, states, companies, artists, etc. But what we see that is happening towards the years is that the scales are starting to tip in favor of Palestinian rights, because there is a growing isolation towards Israeli apartheid. And this is where the BDS movement is taking place and developing, and where this growing support of Palestinian rights and more rejection toward Israeli apartheid is growing. Now, the BDS movement, the Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions movement, represents the broadest coalition of civil society organizations in Palestine, where there's trade unions, women's groups, political parties, etc. And this year is going to be the 15th anniversary of the BDS movement, of 9th of July. And of course, it's inspired in the South African struggle against apartheid, also in the movement for civil rights in the US. And it's important the date that was chosen for the broadest coalition of civil society to ask international community to adopt an active role and actively defend Palestinian human rights was 9th of July, which is a year after The Hague declared that the Israeli apartheid wall is illegal and has to be destroyed, and Palestinian families who were affected by its construction had to be compensated. That was year 2005. It is year 2020, and of course, that wall has not only not been demolished; it keeps on being built every single day. Now, the BDS movement is a non-violent strategy that rejects all forms of racism, sexism, and discrimination, and calls for Palestinian human rights to be respected. It upholds three very basic demands: to end the occupation and colonization of all Palestinian lands and dismantling the wall, to recognizing the fundamental rights of the Palestinian citizens of Israel to full equality, and to respect, promote the rights of Palestinian refugees to return to their homes and properties. All of these demands are enshrined in international law. And I think one of the things that's most powerful of the BDS movement is that Israel, as all colonial powers, try, and I think Fayrouz was explaining it very well, how Palestinian realities are very different, and how Israel plays this game of giving slightly more rights to some Palestinians than others. And what is so powerful about the BDS movement is that it represents Palestinians in the diaspora, Palestinians living under occupation in Gaza and the West Bank, and Palestinians living in 48. And of course, what's crucial to understand is that it is led by a Palestinian population. So when there's groups who want to support Palestinian rights but are not ready to endorse the BDS movement, this means that they're not listening to what Palestinians are asking us to do. And what we need to understand is that when we're not joining the BDS movement, we're actually contributing to harm Palestinians. So the very, very basic we could do is to do no harm, is to make sure that our universities, our institutions, companies are not actively involved in Israeli apartheid and are not contributing to oppression of Palestinians. So what is so powerful about the BDS movement is that it's incredibly empowering. Absolutely anyone can join, and it means taking responsibility in the world we live in, and to actually adopting a proactive measure to make sure that we're not supporting Israeli apartheid, and that it is totally isolated and it will have to respect Palestinian rights. You were asking about how it has developed throughout the years, and I think just seeing the amount of attention that Israel dedicates to the BDS movement shows that it's working, and shows that that Israel cares about the BDS movement, and that it's effective, and it has an impact. In spite of the huge repression Palestinians, of course, and groups in solidarity with Palestine face all over the world, with the Israeli lobby, which is one of the strongest lobbies in the world, we keep on getting victories every single day. And I just wanted to share some that we literally got in the last month, taking into consideration that we're under global lockdown. It is so important. The BDS movement has contributed to mainstream the idea that Israel is in fact an apartheid state. And just today, 47 legal scholars from the UN published a statement stating that if annexation does take place, that this will crystallize apartheid in the 21st century. And of course, as Fayrouz was saying, we know that whether the de facto annexation happens or not, we know there is an annexation on the ground. We know that Israel is an apartheid state. But the fact that now UN legal scholars are ready to say this shows just how far the movement is reaching. And in this statement, it's a very important quote was that the lessons from the past are clear, that criticism without consequences will neither forestall annexation nor end the occupation. So we can see that they're starting to talk about effective measures. And here's where the BDS movement is calling for sanctions. And Palestinian civil society released 3 weeks ago a statement calling for effective measures to stop Israel's illegal annexation of the occupied West Bank, such as banning arms trades and military security cooperation with Israel, suspending free trade agreement with Israel, prohibiting all trade with illegal Israeli settlements, and to ensure that individuals and corporate actors responsible for war crimes and war crimes against humanity are brought to justice. 3 days ago, the European Court for Human Rights ruled unanimously, this is the highest court, that France's highest court criminal conviction of Israel boycott advocates violates the European Convention of Freedom of Expression. And just to show a victory regarding corporate complicity, over a month ago, Microsoft, which needs no introduction at all, everyone knows this company, decided to divest from Anyvision, which is an Israeli company that that offers its services and has joint companies with the Israeli military, offering facial recognition technology, which is so worrying now that in times of COVID, so many governments are going to try to implement. So in such a short period of time, these are the victories we are achieving. And this just shows how powerful the BDS movement is.
Mm-hmm. You just mentioned the United Nations statement a couple of months back. The United Nations, they also published a list of companies that are complicit in the occupation, and I think the list includes about 100, but maybe a little more, companies that provide services or at least profit from the occupation. And there's like a couple of major multinational companies in the list, like Booking.com, Airbnb, and also a couple of Israeli banks that finance or provide financial services to basically sustain the occupation. And so I was wondering if you could say a few words about this database and why it is important that such a list exists.
Yeah, but before the webinar, I just checked, and this came out February 2020, and it seems so much longer ago, like it's before lockdown, and it's crazy how time flies in times of COVID. But yes, as you were saying, in February 2020, the UN released this long-awaited database after all the pressure they were under. And even though we welcome this long-awaited list, there's so many companies that are missing. Even so, it is the first concrete step offered by the UN, and it is important to acknowledge this, that it's leaving the only empty worded resolutions and going to specific and concrete steps. And this database asks that companies should end business with all the companies in this database because they are involved in Israel's illegal settlement enterprise. As you're saying, some of the important companies to highlight are the five Israeli banks that AXA invests in. This is Bank Hapoalim, Bank Leumi, First International Bank of Israel, Mizrahi Tefahot Bank, and Israel Discount Bank. Delta Israel, which is Puma's exclusive licensee in Israel. Shapir, which is CAF's partner for the development of the Jerusalem Light Rail. There's also Delek Group, Egid, General Mills, Motorola, JCB, Alstom, Mekarot, and travel companies such as TripAdvisor, Airbnb, Booking.com, eDreams, and Expedia. Nonetheless, as you just mentioned, there are numerous companies and banks which are directly involved in direct or indirect business activities which are not in the list. Just some of them: G4S, Hewlett-Packard, Elbit Systems, Caterpillar, Hyundai Heavy Industries, Volvo, Heidelberg Cement, Cemex, etc. Many companies that are detailed in the independent Israeli research group Who Profits and in the U.S. project of the American Friends Service Committee investigate. All of these companies have to be included in the database, and it is unacceptable that any international Israeli company that is complicit in enabling, facilitating, or profiting from Israel's regime of oppression enjoys any sort of impunity. What is relevant to say also today, which is news from today, is that Michelle Bachelet, who is the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, just said today that she recommends that the Human Rights Council establishes a group of independent experts with a time-bound mandate to report directly to the council for such a purpose, and that needs a budget in order to keep on updating this database. So we urge the UN to keep on dedicating time and efforts to listen to civil society initiatives who have been documenting for ages all of these companies involved in the settlements and that companies divest from them.
Thank you. So you were saying that there is a couple of Israeli banks in the list to which AXA is connected. So would you be able to be a little more specific and talk about AXA's complicity and its links with these Israeli banks? And there was also an Israeli arms manufacturer to which AXA is connected. Could you explain these connections?
Yeah, I'll try to be brief and explain clearly AXA's in investments. The good news is what I'm going to try to explain, and I hope I show, is that it's clear that AXA is feeling our pressure and that AXA is responding to our campaigning. The campaign against AXA started 3 years ago in France. AXA is a French company. When activists there learned that AXA was investing in Israel's largest arms manufacturer, Elbit Systems, and in three Israeli banks. Therefore, AXA is actively contributing to dispossession, colonization, and Israeli apartheid. In June 2018, this stopped being only a French campaign, and we started the coalition Stop AXA Assistance to Israeli Apartheid. This coalition, to this day, includes groups in Belgium, in Switzerland, in Spain, in France, in Germany, in Italy, and in Ireland. So this campaign has grown at an international level. And what activists have been trying to show is that AXA is not only violating international law, it's even violating its own code of conduct. When activists have been in touch with AXA has said that they have examined these companies and that they do not fall into their companies who should be excluded from investing, which is pretty worrisome, taking into consideration that AXA has developed specific sector guidelines. And these policies include the following topics: not investing in companies which produce controversial weapons, and sanctioned countries or countries identified as having high levels of corruption or political risk. It is hard to think of a country that has a higher political risk than Israel, yet AXA insists in investing in Israeli companies. A major step in our campaigning was that AXA, in December 2018, decided to divest from Elbit Systems, a fully owned AXA subsidiary. AXA IM divested shortly after Elbit acquired IME Systems, which is a large cluster bomb manufacturer. It was then when the campaign decided that we needed specific data of AXA's investments, and the human rights organization Some of Us published in July 2018 the report, which I recommend you all read, AXA Financing War Crimes, which details and explains very well the nature of AXA's investments. At that time, AXA's subsidiary, AXA IM, was investing in four Israeli banks. It had already divested from Elbit Systems, and also AXA owned 64% of AXA Equitable Holdings, which was investing over $91 million in the five Israeli banks, which are mentioned in the UN database, and also in Elbit Systems. What we learned only last month is that AXA has gone from owning 61% of AXA Equitable Holdings to owning only 9%. And AXA Equitable Holdings has actually dropped the name AXA, so it's now Equitable Holdings and registered as an independent company. Therefore, AXA's involvement in Equitable Holdings has dramatically decreased. So therefore, AXA is no longer even the major shareholder of Equitable Holdings. Even so, the campaign states that AXA should fully divest from Equitable Holdings as long as Equitable Holdings doesn't divest from the Israeli banks and Elbit Systems. Regarding AXA IM, which is AXA's fully owned subsidiary, AXA IM no longer invests in Bank Hapoalim, but the bad news is that AXA has tripled its investments in three Israeli banks. Therefore, the pressure on the campaign, of course, remains, and we keep on asking for AXA to fully divest from the Israeli banks and from Equitable Holdings.
You have been listening to Farouz Sharkawi and Alice Samson Estepe speaking on a webinar sponsored by Palestine Podcast. Before we go, I want to read from an article written by Phil Weiss in Mondo Weiss. And I'm now quoting from the article. If you care about Palestinian human rights, the virtual democratic convention was dispiriting. The issue was never mentioned in any of the primetime speeches. The party leadership crushed the party's left-wing base on the question. It was all but removed from the platform per instruction of Joe Biden himself. Kamala Harris is an AIPAC-style Israeli supporter. Joe Biden has been visiting Israel for nearly 50 years and counts every Israeli prime minister, including Netanyahu, as a dear friend, and he went out of his way to throw Linda Sarsour under the bus for her support of BDS. The Democrats' message is clear. Joe Biden is the most pro-Israel president ever. We will not be out-Israeled by Donald Trump. Joe Biden is no Barack Obama, who's going to be a troublemaker on Israel. Why, he just penned a platform to the right of Likud. Reports that the Democratic Party is fracturing over the issue are the fantasies of a few hotheads on the left, as Todd Deutsch and Nancy Pelosi continually assure us. Or, as Pelosi told the Israeli lobby during the last cycle, the Capitol will crumble and will fall before the Democrats walk away from Israel. Palestine is just not a progressive issue the Democrats will have you believe. Biden's aides are willing to play ball on a number of left-wing issues, but not Israel. What appeared less than a year ago to be a party pendulum swinging away from conventional pro-Israel orthodoxies has swung back. The reason is simple. Joe Biden. That was an analysis by Phil Weiss, published in the news service Mondo Weiss, following the Democratic Convention. Strap on your seatbelts. We're in for a rough ride. Okay, that's our broadcast this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You can also stream us live on your computer. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning. من مخيم إلى بلد مهجر من مخيم